Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 2. Okie dokies. Now, the first thing that I want to cover is the labs from Chapter 1. And as I've said before I got started recording, the write-ups of those labs will go up later this afternoon once I've modified the doc files. If you have already submitted your lab, however, I know Pranav has submitted one of the tracing labs, and I think Josh has also done it as well. I will mark that, and that should be fine. Okay, the labs in Chapter 1. There are three labs in Chapter 1, as far as I can tell, three activities. One of them says that you need to be able to use Google Earth. What I'd like people to do is find out the differences between the different editions of Google Earth, which is one of the questions in the lab. Also find out what the system requirements for Google Earth are, if there are any questions asked about that. But you do not actually need to use the application itself, unless of course you have enough vision to do so, and that is optional. So you don't actually have to look around the stuff on Google Earth, but it is kind of cool. I'm just trying to remember though, can anybody tell me, last time I looked at Google Earth, which was a couple of years ago, my soon-to-be ex-wife was playing with it, you needed a Gmail account or a Google account. Is that still the case?
That's usually the case with Google stuff.
Yeah, that was my experience. Does anybody here not have a Gmail address? And if not, why not? Just curious, because I think most people have got one.
I downloaded Google Earth without signing up for a Google account, and I don't have one.
Oh, sweet.
You don't need any account.
Okay. One of the reasons I use Google Mail or Gmail, and I've got a few different email providers. The email provider I recommend if you actually want to pay some money for all your emails and actually have some service is a thing called fastmail.fm, which is a very good IMAP provider. They don't do POP. So if you want POP, they're not the one that you should sign up with. There is a free account, but I think you can't send email through them if you get the free account, and I think it's like $5 or $10 a year or something, but we found that one to be really good. For the Cisco Academy, though, we usually sign people up with Gmail, which is, as far as I know, free, and the IMAP support is really good on it, generally speaking, and it works really well with iPhones and Nokias and other bits and pieces, so that's the one we kind of like. Last time I checked over here in Australia, we actually have to pay for IMAP and POP access through Yahoo. I'm not sure if that's the same in other countries.
Yeah.
It's true in India, at least.
You used to have to pay in America. I don't know about now.
We have to pay in Canada. I mean, I don't have it because I have my own and I have a Gmail and I have enough other accounts. But you do actually, if you want POP access through Yahoo, I think you have to spend money.
Yeah, and I think if you want POP access through Hotmail, if they even do it, you've got to pay as well. Anyhow, they're the pick of the email providers. There's lots of them. I'm sure other people have got favorites. I've got a virtual server with Postlatch.
Just totally replaced because it's now, you know, 80-90% spam.
What, Gmail?
I mean, as a protocol, email is completely saturated with spam. And does it really? Is it worth to us what it costs to constantly be fighting it?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you talk to. Unfortunately, we've found that mailing lists are the best way to get information out to multiple students, and because we've got emails, we then have accountability so that we can say, yes, we did send you that lab or we did send you that worksheet, so we use it for that. I think you could argue that any communications medium gets saturated. Personally, I find commercial television probably about as useful as you find spam-filled email. And I don't tend to watch much of it because I'm sick of seeing six or seven ads every 15 minutes. But I guess it's all personal choice. Okay, so the labs in Chapter 1. We have the Google Earth Lab, which you can answer the basic questions on and leave the actual scrolling around of Google Earth unless you've got sufficient vision to do that, because it is kind of a fun thing to do, provided you've got the bandwidth to do it. But if you can't see, it's currently a little difficult. The other lab involves you looking at a wiki. Somebody's keyed up and they're typing. So if you're keyed up and you're typing, that's you. We would just like you to have a look at, say, something like Wikipedia, or another wiki of your choice. There are a few of them. In fact, there's a Quitter wiki you could go and have a look at that's got some interesting stuff on it. My soon-to-be ex-wife got a keystroke list from there the other day, so there's one you can go and have a look at on quitter-client.net. And there's other ones, of course. The other thing you can also have a look at, we were going to suggest that people for the instant messaging lab, rather than getting on IRC, which is a bit antiquated, we were going to suggest that if people felt motivated enough, they could either use the instant message stuff that they already had to talk about the instant messaging protocols, or you could use Instant Bird. Has anybody played with Instant Bird? There aren't currently any JAWS scripts for it, but it does work reasonably well without them.
It's very cool and very light, and it just sends and receives messages.
I have never heard of that.
How does it compare to, say, something like Miranda?
Easier to set up.
Yeah, I've always found Miranda sort of one of those things like a Swiss Army knife. You don't know what half the little bits and pieces do, and by the time you jam Miro Speak into it and the six other plugins to make it do what we probably want it to do, it is worth it at the end.
Andre Lewis has a really nice pre-configured version that is ready to run. It's got everything pre-set up in it.
Yeah, but it's not up to date.
He constantly updates it. I believe it's like a week behind beta.
Oh, really? I thought it wasn't up to date.
No, that's like...
Why can't you use Skype?
You can.
You can use Skype for instant messaging, although I don't find the Skype instant chat, even with the scripts, I don't find it a very pleasurable experience. I tend to find good old Windows Live Messenger a lot more friendly and easier to grab bits out of, but Skype is usable.
Yeah, agreed. But just for the lab, or are there protocol differences?
Oh, you can use Skype, but what I was going to say is Instant Bird is probably something that nobody's looked at yet, or not very many of us have looked at yet, and I thought it might actually show us another option that might be worth a quick peek. It also does Facebook chat, and there are some people that want to do that. I'm not one of them, but there are some people who, say, for example, want to get on things like LJ Talk or Facebook chat, and Miranda can do that. There are plugins and stuff to make that happen on Miranda. I think the text version, the text bits of Google Talk is just Jabber, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought Pigeon worked under Ubuntu.
You get one of those if you have a Gmail account, so.
Yeah, I thought Pigeon worked okay under Ubuntu and the Linuxes, but I wasn't sure how it behaved under Windows.
I intend to take the libpurple library in Pigeon and use that to build the query IM session.
Yes, Instant Bird is.
Yeah, and I probably will have a look at Andre Lewis's pre-setup installer, which does make it easy for people who want to get running straight away, although I'm sort of one of those people that likes to know what all the little bits and pieces are that are going into this thing. Whilst I'm sure he's eminently qualified to set it up so that it just goes, it would be good to know what is actually in the underlying gizzards of it to make it sort of behave as well as it does. I think the time, if you've got the time to invest in Miranda, it's worth it. Although I do get sick of the away messages, which I know can be disabled, but it's like, yes, we can all see you running Miranda by those custom away messages.
I just use the regular Miranda and then the stripped down MirrorSpeak thing, and that's all I had to do. The main thing that takes long is just setting up the sounds. Other than that, you don't have to do too much. I mean, the sound thing is incredibly tedious and time-consuming and will take, 15 minutes or something, but after that, you don't really have to do too much, just click a couple of things and you're done. It just depends on what, set up the accounts and whatnot, it just depends on what you want to do with it.
Okay, let's get on. So that's the Instant Messenger Lab. Okay, so we'll do that one. I'll sort of formalise something for people to do. If you've got Skype and you want to use it, or you can't be bothered signing up another Instant Messenger account, or you're allergic to, you know, .NET Passport, you know, Microsoft Passport, as long as you've had experience with some sort of Instant Messenger infrastructure, you can certainly... we can work out a method for you to answer the questions in that lab. Okay, the lab's in Chapter 2. I am informed that NeoTrace is partially accessible. You can actually use your JAWS cursor, and it's also possible to press Control Y on the nodes or something, I think Josh was saying yesterday, to get various information out of that, so that might be worth a little bit of playing with. I will have a look at it in the next day or so, and see how much of it I can get to work as well. There is also the command line tool, which you can also use to trace routes, which everybody may have used by now. I think I remember reading somewhere that you need to run TraceRT as an administrator under Windows 7. Is that true?
No, it is not. I ran it under a restricted account.
Okay. I'm not sure where I saw that or why somebody was saying that. There was something you had to run as administrator, which was a bit odd. Now, does anybody not remember how to do output redirection so that you can actually dump the output of your traceroute into a text file for selective inclusion of bits of in the lab? So does anybody not know how to do output redirection in DOS? Seriously, if you don't know how to do it, I'd own up now, because I'm going to go through it if you need to know, but I'm not going to go through it if you don't.
Along with the regular old thing in DOS, you can actually do a complete copy from the current DOS window, Alt Space E, down to Select, and then you just press Enter again, and it will copy the entire window from the beginning of the session, and you can paste it into a notepad or whatever for review.
Okay, well, that's certainly one way of doing it. And there is actually a scrollback history in the cmd.exe windows. The other way to get around it, which is one of the ways we've been doing it for students, is, and the output redirection works fairly similarly to Linux's output redirection, although it's perhaps not as powerful. You can basically, and I'm going to type this into chat, so anybody who's not in chat may not see this. You type in TRACERT, an address, and then you put space greater than, which is on the full stop with the crocodile facing to the left, output.txt. Now, the other thing you've got to keep in mind is that... Did that chop that off? Hang on. Oh, no, that's fine. The other thing you've got to keep in mind is you have to be aware of which directory you are currently sitting in. And I believe under Windows XP, I can't speak for Windows 7, the default directory is your user profile directory. So C documents and settings username if you're running XP, C users, whatever it is under 7. You probably want a CD space desktop, so that the file turns up on your desktop, because I've had all sorts of trouble with people not being able to find the output log files. So when you press enter, it does actually read a path out to you. You probably want to pay attention to that path, or at least change the path with CD space and the path you want to be in, so that you can actually find the output to your traceroute commands. Keep in mind, however, that if you are redirecting the output of the traceroute command, you will see no output until the command prompt returns, because obviously you've redirected it. It will look as though it's locked up, but honestly it hasn't. It's just busy tracing the route and dumping the output to the file, so you may want to run the command without the redirection first, so that you have an idea of whether the trace is going to succeed or fail, and then run it with the redirection so that you can get the bits of information out of the text file. Or you can copy and paste the entire DOS window. Or if you're feeling adventurous, they've changed it in JAWS 11, but in 10 and lower, you can insert Control W and virtualize what's on the current screen, and use Shift and the arrow keys to cut and paste it out that way, and then hit Escape to close the virtual buffer, if you're running JAWS.
I can't remember when they added that. I think that was a 10 thing. Maybe it was a 9 too. I can't remember. Don't think so though.
Yeah, that's true. You can also go Notepad space output.txt will open it up in Notepad wherever you happen to save it. No, that virtualized current window has been in at least since 6.2.
Okay. I stand sprawl corrected.
It's like that Control-Alt-Shift-C or whatever that'll tell you what the cursor shape is that nobody knows about.
Yeah.
Okie dokie, now on to the actual lecture content for Chapter 2. Basically, we're talking about the base terms and concepts that you're going to know when it comes to... Oh, does anybody have any questions before I start? Actually, I should sort of stop and give people a chance to ask any questions if they've got any.
I had trouble trying to find the NeoTrace software to download. I got on a site and it seemed to be kind of buried away somewhere. Seemed to be rather an obscure place to locate it.
I haven't Googled for it myself. Does the link in the curriculum not take you somewhere close to it?
No, it takes it does, it's a little painful. I'll put it in Dropbox and I'll send the link out to the list.
Yeah, okay. That'll work. Otherwise, we can stash a copy up on the extras folder on QCAT. That's usually... I mean, we're sort of... it's sort of... If something's really hard to get to, we'll tend to put it somewhere where it's easy to get hold of. We've sort of got to try and sort of stand a line between things that are too easy to get at and things that are too difficult to get at. So we want to try and sort of strike a happy medium. I do know of a lot of people who see a page with 70 links and then go running towards the cafe because that's far too many links for them to deal with. And we sort of want a bit of an in-between situation where if something's not too difficult to get, we'd prefer you guys get it from the source, but if it is difficult like this NeoTrace probably is, we will make it somewhat easier for you. I believe in making things accessible, but we do want to steer away from sort of making it infinitely simple to navigate, because the real world isn't like that. So yeah, if there's something that is difficult, we will sort of put it up, but if it's not that difficult, we'll send you off to grab it.
How about the wire? I noticed one of the labs has Wireshark. Are you going to put up somewhere the instructions for using the command line options? I understand that that's quite an interesting list.
We'll certainly look at the best way to do that. I'm not 100% sure whether it's best to run Wireshark under Windows or whether I personally usually run TCP dump in a virtual machine. So we'll need to find out which is the best way of doing that.
Doesn't Ethereal have a command line thing?
I thought Ethereal was now called Wireshark.
Oh, I guess I'm just behind the times. Back when I used to play with it, it was called Ethereal, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. It used to be called Ethereal, and now it's called Wireshark, and I think there was some sort of trademark thingy wobbly that they actually changed the name to Wireshark or something. And also, Wireshark kind of sounds cooler if you ask me, but that's just me. Okay, and we will also be looking...
for a wireless network.
Well, wireless has got the word wire in it, so it could be a wireless shark.
That's right. And people are not sharks, I've also noticed.
Depends. How many lawyers do you know? Yes, Alex.
I just None. Found Wireshark 1.4 user's guide. You can click on all the options to find out what the controls, things out there, command line, and such like.
Okay, yeah, well, that's one way of doing it. We will try and collate the useful ones, though, because obviously that's a bit... One of the big problems I have doing packet traces, especially if you're vision impaired, is actually weeding out the information you actually need to see, because if you actually do a packet trace on a network and watch all of the traffic, it can be quite overwhelming to actually target the information that you actually need. So we're yet to find a good packet tracing app for that sort of thing. Well, I was speaking to somebody who actually said that if you were doing an object-oriented model of things, that would be quite an interesting concept of having an object-oriented sort of packet tracer where you have the packets and the various fields and stuff that are the properties of the various bits and pieces of the packet, even something that could go through, you know, Wireshark logs or dumps and do that sort of thing. I don't know, it's something we've been wondering about for years, but generally what I do is I use TCP dump and limit it to the traffic I actually want to see and then log the output and sort of sift through it. We were debugging a Ventrilo connectivity problem the other day, and we were doing it that way, actually looking at the dump of the packet tracing. Okay, so we'll... Yeah, that's true. Sometimes you do need an overview and you're not sure what you're looking for, but TCP dump's part of any Unix system. So I think the virtual machines, which I have got up on the website, have a copy of TCP dump on them. Yeah, WinDump does work. Yep, and just for the recording, netstat-a will show you all of the connections that are open on your current machine, and you can look through netstat-a output and figure out which ones you're actually wanting to have a look at. I think there's also a -B option, which will also tell you what process name opens owns the connection, which is kind of useful as well. Okie dokie, now, okay, so they're things that we're going to work through in the next week or two, and hopefully we can get the Eagle server going so that you guys get to play on the bundle, which is 6 workstations, 3 routers, 3 switches, and various tabley bits, so you can go on there and have a bit of a tamper. I think we're not going to deliberately try and teach you guys too much Linux stuff as we go through this course, but I think it might be inevitable that we will run across a good whack of it. And for those of you who hate command lines, I apologize in advance. You're probably going to see more of them than you'd possibly like. Okie dokie, now we're going to cover the stuff that's... anybody got any other questions that may not be answered in the next week or two that they would like to pose before we move on to the content in this module? Okay, and there's the user guide to Wireshark, which will probably have all sorts of interesting information in there. The other thing to mention to note about things like Wireshark and stuff is that and this is something that's worth mentioning. If all of your machines are connected through a switch, you are only going to see traffic to and from the machine that you're tracing on, and you will also see traffic that is broadcasted, but you won't see traffic to and from the other machines on the network because, as we'll cover, unless, of course, you... have a monitoring port, or you change your MAC address, which we do not recommend because things will go very bad. You can... There are other ways of making it show the packets, but they're not things we're going to cover. As we'll cover later on in the modules, a switch actually has a table that decides where packets are going to be forwarded based on the MAC addresses that the packets are destined to, and it will only forward packets to those specific MAC addresses. It won't forward it to all of the machines on the network, which is why a switch is more efficient, generally speaking, than a hub. Good luck getting hubs these days. They're quite hard to source. You can get your hands on them, but they're not really utilized that much. And I will define MAC address later on in this module. Now, has everybody read this chapter? Has anyone not read this chapter, I should say?
I haven't. I've been working on websites and other tech support for people, unfortunately.
Okie dokie. Well, you did this last time in Discovery, so you should be pretty right. Anyone else not read the chapter?
Yeah, I haven't read it either. I'll own up.
Alright, well, if you haven't read the chapter, we'll pretend that you did, okay? So, three common elements of communication. No, there's no anonymous way of dropping your name into chat, unfortunately. Now, the other thing I'm just going to mention before we continue on, and I'm not going to dob the particular person in who this happened to, but one of our students undertook the ITE 1 skills test and didn't open the diagram descriptions and didn't do too well. And funnily enough, we got them to retake the IT1 skills exam, and with the diagram descriptions open, and things went a lot better. So just keep that in mind, people. The diagram descriptions are there for you to use and get better marks. So do try and open them up. And given the fact that our server is up and down like a yo-yo, I would recommend that people, for the next week or so, save the diagram descriptions on their hard drive before they take the exam, just in case QCAT.org goes bye-bye in the middle of your exam. Okay, there are three common elements of communication. Message source, the channel that the stuff is travelling over, and the message destination, okay? I don't think we need to elaborate on that too much, except to say that if you've got two people having a conversation, you've got one person who is talking, and you've got the air that the message is travelling through, and then you've got one person that is theoretically listening, that is the receiver of that conversation. Or in this particular case, we have a multicast situation where a whole lot of students are listening to the lecture. Okay, good morning, Shazia. We've seen you drop on there, and that's all good. Now the thing they wanted to... remember last week we spoke about the difference between circuit-switched and packet-switched networks. We said that circuit-switch established a circuit, and the information travelled over, and then if that circuit was broken, you'd have to re-establish another circuit, which was how the old telephone exchanges used to work. And then we talked about packet switching, which is where the message is broken down into smaller... in TCP it's generally broken down into segments, and then the lower level than that are the packets. The message is actually split up into packets so that the information can be sent across the network and it can be error checked and corrected and all of that sort of good stuff. Now, the packets... this is somewhat complicated because you do actually have to reassemble the message when it reaches the other end, and there are sort of sequence numbers and stuff inside the packets that allow out-of-order delivery of messages, so the protocol has to be able to handle that. However, the good thing with having information broken down into packets is that you can actually do what we call time division multiplexing. Now, multiplexing is the ability to send more than one conversation down a particular communications link at a time. There are actually two types of multiplexing. One is time division, and the other is frequency division. Now, can anybody give me an example of where frequency division multiplexing would be used in a residential environment? Anybody got any idea where we might use that? Cell phone. I was looking for another. Usually used in the home. A different one. Anybody got any other ideas where we might use frequency division multiplexing? Wi-Fi does use it. Also, ADSL uses it. You've got the frequency band for your voice, and you've got the frequency bands for your data. And I also believe that cable television internet stuff uses frequency division multiplexing, which means that the different messages are sent on different frequencies or different channels. Yeah, cable TV, that also uses it. We don't have a lot of cable in Australia because nobody wants to run the cables that far unless you're in a city. And Australians seem to be allergic to paying for their television. Okay, yes, hello Shazia, we can see your messages into chat. We usually don't stop when people turn up late though, so onwards, when upwards, or downwards, depending on how you want to look at it. Okay. Hang on, we haven't got anyone stuck in the lecture, have we?
I think so.
Yeah, we do, hang on, I'll get her. Yep, Grace will go and get her. Good. Okay. That's not the window I want. Okay. Most people have used networks. Most people have used extensive networks. We want to cover the components. So you've got things like hardware, software, and the various bits and pieces that run on the actual network. Okay, now, networks need end user devices, and there are several classifications of end user devices. You have clients, you have servers, and you have machines that can act as both clients and servers. Now, can somebody other than Christopher, who knows the answers to most things, tell me what a server is?
A server could be any device that is capable of sending information onto the internet, aka a web page, or even your computer can be a server, like a personal web server.
That is an example of a server. It's generally a device that can provide services to other devices, and depending on what that device is, it depends on what sort of services it provides. Often you have a print server that serves out printers, you have a file server that serves out files, and I think some of the new Nokia phones and stuff can actually act as a music server and all those sorts of weird things. Not that I've played with it myself. Alright, somebody other than Christopher, who have been knocked out of the current answering round for the moment, can somebody else tell me what a client is?
A client is any host that is accessing a server. Generally, most people who are on a network are clients.
Yes, and some people will tell you that clients are those annoying people that come in and annoy the customer service team, but that's not the sort of client we're after here. So, but yes, clients are devices that access the services of a server. And if you have machines that are acting as both a client and a server, you can actually set up what we call peer-to-peer networks, which is where the devices all have a fairly equal role and they share out the responsibility of providing the services. Okie dokie. So we need to know what clients and servers are. That's important. Okay, now there are intermediary devices, such as routers and things. They are responsible for routing traffic. They are responsible for forwarding data to various locations and stuff. They are responsible for making intelligence decisions as to where traffic is to travel, if you think about routers and that sort of thing. Okay, now we need to basically define network media. So you're looking at your copper cabling, such as your twisted pair, your coaxial cable, those sorts of things. You're looking at optical fiber, which is thin strands of glass or plastic that can take light radiation in either the visible band or the infrared band. And you also have wireless, which obviously is what it says. It's the stuff that goes through the air. Various wireless technologies which we won't cover, but things like wireless LANs, microwave links, Bluetooth, all of that sort of good stuff. So that's obviously the sort of mediums that things can travel over. Okie dokie, any questions so far? It's all pretty pedestrian stuff.
How much, I'm just curious, if there's been any success in getting the internet to transmit over microwave?
Yeah, there are plenty of devices that use plenty of devices that use microwave communications. There are probably microwave links on the internet. You've got to be careful with microwave radiation, because if you get enough watts, you can cook things if you've got the right wavelength. So obviously microwave links tend to be line of sight, and they need to be in situations where they're not going to interfere with stuff. And I think that's probably pretty important, because you obviously don't want to be cooking things. There's one of those things that if you believe everything that you read on OMG Facts, apparently radar was discovered when somebody walked past a radar dish and... microwaves were discovered when somebody walked past a radar dish and the chocolate bar in their pocket melted. Now, to be honest, if you believe that, you'll believe anything, but you never know, there might be a grain of truth in that.
I thought it was because his head exploded, just like on Scanner.
Probably not, but I'm sure that would be... some people would find that scenario more entertaining.
I think microwaves... when I worked at Tektronix, microwaves were mainly used for... in place of the long cables to connect buildings together.
Yeah, they often are used for that. They're also often used for links that are, say, 10, 20, 30 kilometres long, and they usually use focusing dishes and stuff to get those sorts of links to work reliably and at long distances. But, I mean, apparently, microwaves are certainly also used for warming your dinner up. Although, from what I read somewhere, it's most radio waves, if there's enough of them, will actually cause water molecules to vibrate. It was just that the microwaves were made in a band that wasn't going to conflict with other stuff. So, there you go.
One of the problems with microwave links is that they are interceptable. Some bad guy can stick a sniffer up in the... microwave stream and read what's going on the network without being detected.
Well, if it's line of sight, wouldn't it be seen anyway?
No, well, it's invisible.
The guy setting up some kind of intercept station.
Not really. I mean, he could just put something in the beam within the 20 kilometers, and it wouldn't need to be there for a long period of time. So I think it's just a case of, you know... But, I mean, a lot of wireless networks are... prone to security problems. And that's why a lot of organisations have... They have security on their links. They have encryption. They have all of those sorts of things to stop people from sniffing what's going on the links. Okay, now a local area network is a network that is local to a particular administrative... usually the way they define it on Cisco is it's an area, that's a network that's like in a building or a campus or in a local area, but it's generally speaking under one administrative control zone. And because of that, it means that the network... the local area network is controlled by, you know, one group of people, and it's generally low latency, or it's supposed to be low latency, and it's a fairly dense collection of machines and stuff. Okay, now if you're going to connect local area networks together, you're going to connect them together by using wide area networks, and they are the links that tend to be, they're generally slower than LAN links, they tend to be long distance, with long distance being a relative term, and you generally get increased latency and stuff over wide area networks. Often the wide area network links are more expensive, and if you're in Australia and stuff, you will tend to pay for time and volume. Okie dokie. We have an ADSL link that sometimes decides that it's time to drop the ball for no good reason. And yes, we do have a Cisco router on it, but that doesn't seem to make much difference. So local area networks are all, you know, close together and that sort of thing. Now, wide area networks tend to have links with higher latency. and they tend to be long distance links, and depending on where you are, those links tend to cost money for time, volume, or bandwidth. And in fact, if you are using commercial grade wireless links that are quite fast and specialized, there are actually, if you're using certain subsets of them, you actually do have to pay for licensing to be able to run those links, because they do run on frequencies that cost money for you to use. So as a result, it probably pays to not put all of your traffic over the WAN if you can help it, which is why you've got routers and things to actually govern which traffic is travelling over the WAN and which traffic is going over your LAN and stuff, which is why you have to be pretty sensible with your traffic routing. Now, obviously, the internet is a really big network of interconnected networks, which is why it's called the internet, and I believe it even has a capital I, which is good for it. You can actually have that... yes, Joshua, you just typed hello into chat. Okie dokie, and we have internet because my Twitter is working, which is always a good thing.
Yep, you're still here.
Now, we spoke about protocols a bit last week, but it is important that devices have a protocol and they have rules to communicate so that they know what data is going to be sent, they know what data they're expecting to receive, they know how to handle error conditions, and all of these things need to be specified as far as a protocol is concerned, otherwise things go very bad. There are open protocols, such as the TCP/IP protocol suite, and then there are closed protocols, which are proprietary to a specific organization. I believe there was a time when NetBIOS, which is now what the older version of what we call SIFS, was actually proprietary. And it actually took some reverse engineering work on the behalf of the Samba team to actually get that working on other operating systems other than Windows.
Does anyone still use anything that's not TCP/IP?
There are other protocols. There are IPX-SPX, which is the Novell protocols. There's NetBUI. There's all sorts of other protocols that sort of sit around. Ah, okay, Grace is off grabbing a stupid jolly. Some people do use it. I mean, even Novell has moved towards TCP/IP, though. So, I mean, TCP/IP is pretty ubiquitous. There are other protocols such as DNA and stuff that are in the mainframe industry that are used in certain specific transaction-based protocols that don't necessarily rely on TCP/IP, and they are used in certain specialized applications. If you think about things like serial communications, which some people still do, and in fact it's kind of funny to see how technology has sort of become full circle, where you actually get people who hook their mobile phones up to their computer and they do it over a PPP connection to get on the internet with their mobile cellular providers. It's certainly a method of data communication that a lot of people aren't familiar with setting up. And you actually have a modem in your mobile phone, and you can either set it up with PC Suite and do the I want to connect to the internet and plug the details in all automatically and have it automatically come up and work. Or if, like me, you don't particularly enjoy installing PC Suite onto various computers, you can also do it by hand by putting in the necessary dial strings into dial-up networking and stuff, and that will get the networking up and running with a far smaller footprint than having the entire of PC Suite installed.
You could always put it on and then uninstall it when you're done with it, but it's, I don't really like using the PC Suite either. It's pretty painful.
Yeah, you do get a lot of registry crud left behind, though. And if you're running, say, a netbook or something, often it can be far more efficient to set the connection up by hand and put the dial strings into the dial-up networking, because you don't really want to be loading the netbook down with unnecessary software. Okie dokie, now we get into the heavy stuff. Now, to keep in mind that the protocols... there are some... There are some alternatives to iTunes, but I think they only deal with putting music on and off the thing. I don't think as far as turning the accessibility on and off, you need iTunes to be able to do that. There are other options such as Rhythmbox and stuff that could talk to older generation of stuff, but I'm not sure what the other options to that would be now, because I think Apple tightened it all up and stopped people from doing that outside of their software. Sometimes Skype will go through and do a number on your microphone settings, or sometimes the Windows Mixer will just decide not to save its state, and that can be a bit of a pain as well. So maybe...
Conrad, come up to the lobby with me. I'll try and help you fix it.
Keep in mind, though, Grace, that chat is global, so we're all going to see your chat messages.
Oh, never mind, then. We'll do it later.
Yeah, probably a good idea. Or you can drop off and do it if you want, but yeah, chat is global. Oh, yeah, otherwise you can open a private chat, Grace. That's the other way you could get around it. Okay, network networks. The protocols specify the underlying functionality. They don't necessarily specify how that is actually meant to be achieved. The reason they do that is so that you can run TCP/IP over all sorts of different mediums, whether you're running it over serial cables, optical fibers, wireless links, all of that sort of thing. You can change the underlying mediums without actually having to change all of the protocols that run above that. Now, it's probably worth mentioning here that we're going to start talking about layered models. Now, these layered models are actually a concept. They are sort of a wishy-washy thing that we talk about that's meant to make things easy to understand, although in the beginning it usually doesn't. And you need the layers to explain how the different protocols interact, but the layers themselves don't actually exist. There's no layers sort of floating in the air on a wireless network. So you send the stuff down into the application layer, and this application layer that's floating in the air sort of eats the packets, and then they go down to the presentation layer, and then it goes. That's sort of virtually what happens, but it doesn't actually physically happen, if you like. So these are a conceptual thing. Now,
virtual layer king.
Go ahead. Well, yes, and life is a simile. Okay, so yeah. Now, protocols design is kind of useful because it fosters competition. It causes things to be interoperable from various vendors. I remember back in the late 90s, or even the mid-90s, there was a whole lot of protocols that wouldn't interoperate. You had, you know, Banyan Vines, or you had Nivelle, or you had PCNFS, and depending on what you could talk to. And I know an organization that spent $1,500 per network card on an Exos 205 network card because it had a 186 processor on the network card, and it was capable of speaking multiple protocols under DOS. So they bought a stack of these, and they were very expensive. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is that changes in one layer of a network design do not affect the other layer of the design. So, if we want to go through, say, for example, a layered model, and we usually go through this one because it's fairly easy to understand, if you look at the image of posting a letter, you take the information that you want to put in the letter, you write it down on a piece of paper, or print it out onto a piece of paper. You then encapsulate that piece of paper into an envelope. Once the piece of paper is encapsulated into the envelope, you then put addressing information on the envelope. You then take that envelope down to the post office, or somehow get it to the postie people, and they use that addressing information to route the letter that you have sent by whatever means necessary, whether that be cars, trains, planes, all that sort of thing, to the destination. And then when the receiver gets the letter, they pull it out of the letterbox or wherever it turns up, and they open up the envelope, which decapsulates the message, and then they read the piece of paper which has your letter on it. Obviously, most people do this with email, and it happens a lot faster and sometimes more reliably. Now, there are two models that we're going to talk about. One of those models is the TCP/IP model, and the other layer model is the OSI reference model. Now, a lot of students ask me, how do I remember these? How am I going to learn these? And the reality is that when you first see this stuff, it all looks rather complicated and rather confusing, and once you've finished pretty much with the course, you should be fairly familiar with it, and it should come to you fairly naturally. That's the theory anyway. If you're sighted, people tend to print out the lists of these things and stick them on the toilet door or something so they can stare at them when they've got time to do that. Or you can, I don't know, whatever other memory aids you happen to use will help you to remember these different things. Now, before I go into the layers of the OSI reference model, does anybody have any questions so far? Yep.
Hi, I was wondering, so the TC, does the OSI model, does information travel on the OSI model and then does the TCP layers kind of sit on top of the OSI layers or something like that?
I think this was covered in the latter part of the chapter. No. The layers of the TCP model can be mapped to the OSI reference model in a fashion. So there are layers of the TCP model that that map across the layers of the OSI reference model. So, say for example, we'll go through the layers of the OSI reference model first. There are seven layers in the OSI reference model. There is the physical layer, which is responsible for the physical medium that is going to send the information across the network, such as wires, cables, optical fibre, wireless, and that tends to concern itself with signalling specifications, voltages, power levels, that sort of stuff. The next layer up from that is the data link layer, which concerns itself with the framing of the data. So generally speaking, at the Ethernet layer, you're looking at the data link layer where you're actually putting the packets onto the Ethernet. The data link is actually broken into two sub-layers, which we won't go into at the moment, called MAC, which is Media Access Control, and Logical Link Control, which we will cover in a future chapter. So we have physical data link. We have the network layer, which is responsible for the addressing and stuff of the various data. So it handles the addressing of the source and destination of the packets and stuff. It also tends to handle the routing. So that's network. We then have the transport layer, which is responsible for retransmission of packets. It's responsible for packet acknowledgement. It's responsible for error detection and, in some cases, correction. We then have the session layer, which is responsible for the opening and closing of various sessions. So if we consider an SSH connection, an HTTP connection, or something like that, or an SMTP connection, that would be sort of similar to the session layer, actually opening that session, doing the communication, and then taking that down. We then have the presentation layer, which is responsible for things such as character set conversion and the way that the data is presented. And then you have the application layer, which is where the application talks to the particular networking stack, and then the packets travel all the way down through the OSI reference layer model down to the bottom physical layer and then back all the way up to the other side. Please do not throw sausage pizza away, is one way of remembering them. Physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application. Please do not throw sausage pizza away. Or if you'd like to keep your IT job, you can look at it the other way and say all people seem to need data processing. There are two mnemonics I know of. There are a whole lot of other ones. We had a rather offensive one that referred to Australia Post at one point. That's something that people can Google up if they want to find that one. But whatever mnemonic works for you to be able to remember the layers of the OSI reference model. Now, the OSI reference model itself, there are very few protocols that are actually designed that work on the OSI reference model itself. The OSI reference model, however, is a tool that lets us understand how the protocols work and how the protocols interoperate and stuff. And it also means that you can sort of look really clever by going, oh, I think there's a problem at layer one, which obviously boils down to somebody not plugging the cable in, or if you say that there's a problem at layer 8, you're obviously referring to the user that's sitting behind the keyboard, but generally you don't do that in the presence of the user. Okay, any questions on the OSI reference model so far? And we will cover a lot more of this as we go through the various chapters and stuff, but that's sort of the brief on the back of a postcard overview. Now, OSI is Open Systems Interconnect, and they're one of the standards groups that sat down and did all of the work on this OSI reference model. Now, the TCP/IP model, which came out before the OSI reference model, is the one that is in most common use today. And it has an application layer, it has a transport layer, it has a network layer, and it has a network access layer. Okay, the network access layer is analogous to layers 1 and 2 of the OSI reference model, so that is physical and data link. You then have the network layer of the TCP/IP model is pretty much analogous to the network layer of the OSI reference model. We then have a transport layer of the TCP model, which is similar to the transport layer of the OSI reference model. And we then have session, presentation, and application are all bundled together into the application layer of the TCP/IP protocol. Wow, sweet model thing. Any questions so far? And there is a lot in this lecture. I wouldn't be surprised if some people have to go back over this again. I know it took me about 3 goes when I did it in TAFE back in 1995 to get all of this into my head.
So what are the TCP/IP layers?
They are application, transport, network, and network access. Okay, now the other thing that's worth mentioning here is that when data is encapsulated and it goes down through the various layers of the OSI reference model, or it goes down through the various layers of the TCP model, depending on which one you're looking at, each time it goes down through a particular layer on the model, you actually need to add headers and sometimes trailers onto the data. The data needs to be encapsulated, so when the data, say for example, goes from the application layer down to the transport layer in the TCP model, you need to add the various transport level headers, which would be things like your sequence number and stuff in TCP, and the port numbers, which I'll talk about in a minute. And then as you go down to, say, the network layer, you'd be looking at adding your addressing information, such as your IP addresses and that sort of thing. And then when you go down to the data link layer, that's when you start looking at things like the MAC address. Now, can anybody tell me what a MAC address is?
I think every vendor has a specific number, sequence of numbers and letters, which it assigns to a piece of hardware. And that's what's used when you do hardware-to-hardware communication.
The MAC address is actually 48 bits, and it's the letters, it's all a hexadecimal code.
It certainly is. Most MAC addresses, generally speaking, on Ethernet at least, and wireless networks are 48 bits long. The first 24 bits of the MAC address are the OUI, or the Organizational Unique Identifier, which is what Pranav was alluding to a minute ago. They are the first 3 bytes of the MAC address, which are assigned by the particular vendor. And in fact, if you are running something like ARPWatch, which I would strongly recommend if you've got a Linux box, ARPWatch rocks. It emails you when new stations pop up on your network, so you can see when people are jumping on your wireless network and stuff. Yes, you can fake the MAC addresses, and yes, you can ARP poisoning, and yes, you can do all sorts of other nasty things, but on my network, it at least tells me when new devices come up, and I can see what's actually coming up without having to sift through the DHCP logs. So ARPWatch, very cool. The MAC addresses are generally assigned by the manufacturer. They can be overridden by deranged/clever network administrators. They can also be overridden by users who just go into the advanced properties and twiddle all the knobs to see what happens. However, note that generally speaking, setting the MAC address on a card to the MAC address of another device on your network, if you're going to send any traffic from the second device, is often going to cause things to break in quite interesting ways. So do it at your own risk. MAC addresses
Windows
operate
might throw up about 86,104 different warnings if you try and do that. Change the address.
I've never tried it. I assume it would. I mean, Linux, you can just put it in on the ifconfig command line and it does it if it can.
Nah, it doesn't throw any warnings. Windows is quite happy for changing
the operating assumption is that Linux users are intelligent, so that's the problem.
And that's not always... I think that's... whilst that would be nice if that was always the case, I think we have to understand that Linux, like every operating system, has the ability to be used or abused by all classifications of the population, and sometimes you will find that the users who are using Linux are not... perhaps your definition of intelligent. We actually had a situation where, I think I've told this story before actually, I don't know whether I told it in this class, we had an old woman that was having her computer infected by all sorts of viruses and malware and stuff, and my friend went and installed Ubuntu Desktop Edition onto it, and said, look, if you don't like this in a week, I'll put Windows back on, and he turned up in a week, and she said, don't you dare take this Ubuntu off, I reckon it's great, and she hasn't had any problems with the machine, and it's been about 4 or 5 months since Ubuntu was installed, and she's as happy as a user can be expected to be. Somebody keyed up briefly, did somebody want to say something? Obviously, if you talk to the Windows zealots, they will tell you that Windows is the best operating system, and I've met some people who genuinely go on with this sort of stuff, and they believe it. And then you talk to the Mac people, and they say that the Mac is the best operating system there is, and they believe that too. And then you've got the Linux users, who then all get together in a room with some boxing gloves and have an argument about which distribution is the best, but they all unanimously sort of say that Linux is better than all the other ones. So it all depends on who you talk to and what they actually think, as to which operating system is good or bad or indifferent or whatever. I mean, we used to speak to the Amiga people and they reckon their operating system was really great. Okie dokie. Now, obviously, we've talked about MAC addresses. We have now going to talk about IP. Now, MAC addresses are used at layer 2 of the OSI reference model, or they're used at the network access layer of the TCP/IP model. At the networking layer of both models, we use the IP address. Anybody tell me how many bits in an IPv4 address?
32.
There are 32. Count them. No, just kidding. Usually, IP addresses are written in what we call dotted decimal notation, which involves having 4 decimal numbers between 0 and 255 separated by full stops. So, for example, 192.168.1.1. Anybody tell me how many bits are in an IPv6 address? Anybody know?
128.
Yes, it is 128. I read something that said that we are so short on IPv4 address space that by the year 2012 we'll have to move towards IPv6, which is kind of sad because I've been seeing, whilst I'm sure this is actually going to happen, I've been seeing this stuff like we're going to run out of IP addresses in 1995 and then we're going to run out in 1997 and by the year 2000 we'll be out and then by the year 2003 we'll be out again. And so apparently by the year 2012, when everything else is supposed to happen, we will also run out of IPv4 addresses. So who knows? but there is some pressure to...
It's actually been written on a sandstone tablet that the very last IPv4 address will be given a minute before 12:21 on September 21st, 2112.
Jolly good. So you'll have 60 seconds to send 60 packets at one packet per second before the world as we know it does whatever the world we know it.
That's where it starts. Like, it all starts. The eclipse will happen right after the guy tries to get an IPv4 address but can't.
That'll be a cascade thing that will bring down the rest of the world. Okay. And if you're listening to this recording and you're not here at this lecture and you cannot sense the incredible sarcasm that is currently on channel...
If you're listening from 2013, then you can laugh.
That's right. It all didn't happen. I think... No, they're 128 bits. Josh, they're definitely 128 bits. And in fact, if you want confirmation of that, there is a Thursday chat I gave on IPv6 which talks about exactly how many bits and how we route them and all that sort of good stuff. Most modern operating systems have IPv6 support. Although, interestingly enough, Windows 7 has it. There is an optional component you can install into Windows XP. Which you go, if you've got Service Pack 1 or greater, you can go to the command prompt and type IPv6 space install. But I wouldn't recommend people do that because it sticks in a whole stack of other network interfaces that then become annoying when you do IP config output. Unless you have a genuine need for IPv6, I wouldn't put it in. Most IPv6, there are IPv6 portions of the internet that run exclusively IPv6. However, most people are tunneling IPv6 over IPv4, and they're using... tunnel brokers such as Freenet and other ones that actually resolve to channel that information across the existing infrastructure.
Vista, I believe, comes with an IPv6 SAC.
What does, sir?
Vista does, I think. I know 7 does. I'm pretty sure that they added it in Vista because they reworked the networking stack for Vista.
There is IPv6 support in Vista. There is IPv support in Windows 7. There is IPv6 support in most Linuxes, which a lot of us turn off because it just is more trouble than it's worth. Sometimes there is IPv6 in MuTorrent, ironically enough, and you can use IPv6 enabled torrents. Some people do have IPv6 turned on. It's just a lot of us turn it off because it can cause some problems, especially when you try to do DNS resolution and you get AA records back and then you don't have any IPv6 connectivity. That can make things time out and it can be quite nasty. Mac OS X has IPv6, I think I said that. So most modern operating systems have IPv6 support.
So how hard would it really be to switch over at this point now that it's pretty mainstream? It's just not used, but it's available.
The problem is a lot of the routers and a lot of the ISP routers are still set up for IPv4, and they are going to be forced into doing it. I also heard an NPR report that said next year that they are really going to have to start switching over rather fast, and it would obsolete a lot of old equipment.
That's certainly a problem, and a lot of your home routers, for example, don't have IPv6 support. There was actually a firmware that was released for the Linksys WRT54G whatever routers by Earthlink, and it has IPv6 support in it. I have no idea whether that got much widespread or whether things like Kamikaze or... my mind's gone blank. The other distributions that can run on the OpenWRT, whether they can and do support IPv6.
DDWRT.
Yeah, DDWRT is the other one, and Svsoft, which nobody runs, but yeah. Some people do, but not many. Or OpenWRT probably has IPv6 support in it as well. But yes, it is going to obsolete a lot of equipment, and iOSs that are less than 11 point something don't have IPv6 support, and there are a whole stack of Cisco routers that will not run IPv6, and they will be relegated to propping the door open and stuff like that. So it is quite a big switchover. There are parts of Japan and China that are using IPv6 already. It's not really what I was talking about today, but anyway, these things happen. It is sort of mind-boggling to think that there are people that are handing out /64 prefixes in IPv6, and that means you end up with 2^64 addresses, which is quite a lot. A lot of places are now realizing that handing out /64 prefixes is not too cool, so they are actually handing out /96 prefixes to like home users and stuff, and that still leaves you with 32 bits of address space for your house. So that's the amount of IP address space that we had in IPv4 you can probably get inside your house, so that everything in your house could have an IPv6 address. Anybody got any questions, comments before we move on? Okay, so when you're dealing with TCP/IP, there is a concept that you should know about called port numbers. Now, port numbers are a number that's given to what we call a port or a socket, and they are a method of differentiating different communications between between different programs and that sort of thing. So, for example, you don't usually get instant messenger output popping up in the middle of your email, or you don't get Facebook popping up in the middle of... Okay, you do get Facebook popping up in the middle of... You don't get email popping up in the middle of your web browser unless you're using webmail, obviously. So various protocols use various port numbers, and the port numbers differentiate what the protocol is going to do. So you have some common stuff that runs on port. Say, for example, HTTP runs on port 80, and SMTP runs on port 25, and DNS runs on port 53, and it depends on what protocol you've got. There are lists of various ports that the different protocols are expected to run on in their standard configuration. Obviously, there is a source IP address and a source port, which is where the connection comes from. And then there is a destination IP and a destination port, which is where you connect to. So generally, what happens when you visit a website under Windows is you end up with a source IP address of your local machine, which is sort of 192 or 10. Or whatever if you're behind a NAT, and a source port, which connects to the target web server on port 80. And then that packet is run through the network address translator, and the traffic goes to the web server, and then the returning traffic is sent back to the machine that's sending the packet out originally, and the network address translator unwraps that again and hands it back to the machine that originally sent the information out. Any questions on that so far?
Is it true that a network address translator will not allow a packet to come in unless one was originated out?
Depends on the design of the network address translator. If you're actually doing static one-to-one NAT, which is where you NAT an internal address to an external public address, then packets coming in on the external address will be translated back across onto the internal address, and that will actually give you complete transparency if you're using one-to-one NAT.
In regards to firewalls on routers, though, that's pretty much the case, but that's what UPnP is for.
It's what UPnP is for. It's for what NAT-PMP is for. It's for what STUN, Secure Traversal of UDP Network Datagrams through Network Translators. There's various protocols to get you through network address translation stuff and through routers and stuff. And obviously, that's something that is something that people would want to use, especially if you're doing things like VoIP, which is generally speaking the protocols for VoIP, which is RTP and there's another one, SIP. Unless you've got various proxies, application level proxies and stuff, they're not particularly NAT friendly, which is why we need protocols such as STUN.
Bring on IPv6. the more this and that sense.
Well, that remains to be seen. Whilst IPv6 may get rid of a lot of network address translation, we're certainly going to have to rethink the way we firewall and secure our devices. I personally don't feel like going on the internet without some level of protection, such as a firewall or whatever. And a lot of the natural protection that a network address translator offers when you're sitting behind one will be lost if we don't use network address translation or some other cloaking technique on IPv6. Sometimes it's fun to get an unpatched Windows machine and connect it directly to the internet and see how many seconds it stays up for before somebody absolutely obliterates it on the internet. So that's about what we have in the chapter notes for today. So unless anybody's got anything else that they want to discuss or questions that they want to ask, that's it for chapter 2 for the moment. I think I'm going to find some food and play with servers and then come back and rewrite some labs for the rest of you to do in the next week or two for modules 1 and 2. They won't be anything overly complicated, but they will be something to help impress the knowledge in these chapters a little bit better. In fact, I might even run the quiz next week.
The main thing that
I was just going to ask
me,
when the exam was up.
I can activate the exam today if people... in fact, I will activate
Don't
the
yet.
Exam today for a week. Why not?
Because I'll explain it. Later today, it'll be fine. I just have to do that on enrollment.
Ah, yeah, okay, no worries. No problem. Okay, so the exam will be activated later today and I'll announce it on the list. And I'll put all the exams up for a week. So if you think you're really, really smart, you can go through and sit all the chapter exams. Won't get you out of all the labs, but you can do as many of the chapter exams as you want. And obviously see how you go. So the exams will go up later today.
And you can take those exams 3 times, right?
Twice, I think, is the default. I've got to figure out what I've got set for the class profile. I think it is 3. But I think the thing you've got to ask yourself is if you're getting to the point where you've taken the exam twice and you're still getting a crummy score, maybe, just maybe, you want to talk to us and we go through the exam with you and figure out what you're having trouble understanding, because it possibly points to a problem with the understanding of the chapter. So if anybody wants to, anybody else got any other questions or things that they want to talk about before we hit the stop button, we can certainly do that.
I was just going to say, the thing that kind of makes me nervous about IPv6 is the idea that you can, because I believe this is true, that in IPv6 you don't get dynamic IP addresses, so everyone pretty much all the time will have the same IP address, which at that point you basically don't even need tracking cookies, because everyone, you know, you basically have a unique ID on the internet, and that kind of freaks me out a little bit.
You can get dynamic IP addresses, and there are ways of handing out dynamic addresses. There'll be less of a need for a dynamic address because there will be enough addresses to hand out to specific devices. But then again, your ISP's got logs of who you are anyway, so they've sort of got you either way.
The ISP does, and the law enforcement can retrieve those logs in a criminal investigation. That doesn't bother me, but bothers me is the idea of anyone on the internet being able to go, oh, this IP, I've seen this before.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, you were going to say something, ask something, mention something, Brian?
Yeah, you talked about having a quiz next week. Those are presumably live in class, and it concerns me because next week is going to be from a hotel wireless, and those are sometimes wonderful and sometimes very iffy at best.
Would it make you feel any better if I said that the quiz was just to help people understand the material and it won't actually count towards your grade? Because that's all that it is. It's just to test people and their understanding, not actually to go towards your grade.
Yeah, that helps some, because I'm going to be in a hotel in Florida next week, and I know, well, people don't go to Florida in August, but what can you do? So, it's all at the whim of a hotel wireless, which I've had varied experience with.
Let me just think about how robust Ventrilo is. I have actually been able to do Ventrilo on a cell phone's connection, 2G connection before, and sort of make it work. So 2G, you should be okay.
And if you know, we understand.
2004 school.
Hold on right back.
Yes, Alex.
So for those of us that have a little bit of sight, should we just follow on the chapter labs as they are, or should we do the ones that you get?
If you are capable of doing the labs as they stand and do the labs as they stand, and if you have enough sight and the inclination to play with Packet Tracer, it is a cool bit of kit, and we're not going to stop you from doing that, but there will be some of us who will not enjoy Packet Tracer very much at all. However, it goes without saying that if you actually send your lab in publisher format or embedded in a JPEG, then I possibly won't give you the mark that you would like for that lab.
That'd be a lot of work.
Believe me, I had some students once who submitted their labs in publisher format, and it was very difficult to read because they didn't own a copy of Microsoft Word, and, well, yeah.
So
I would have just wrote them in Notepad.